The Free Library of Philadelphia is proud to present a podcast from our award-winning author events series, recorded live at the Parkway Central Library on the Benjamin Franklin Parkway. To learn more about the Free Library, our unique and inspiring collections, and how your contribution can help our programs and services for the community, please visit freelibrary.org. Welcome to the Free Library of Philadelphia. I'm Andy Cahan, Director of Author Events, and I am very excited to introduce our guests. The last time Viet Thanh Nguyen was at the library was the night after he won the Pulitzer for his 2015 novel, The Sympathizer. Perhaps if he'd waited another month to have this talk, it might have happened again. In the meantime, he joins us to tell us about the sequel, The Committed, a literary thriller and a novel of ideas that continues the story of The Sympathizer's main character, the man of two minds, as he experiences the delights and dangers of Paris circa the early 1980s. The novelist Ocean Vuong writes, "The Committed, like all daring novels, is a Trojan horse whose hidden power is a treatise of global futurity in the aftermath of colonial conquest. It asks questions central both to Vietnamese everywhere and to our very species. How do we live in the wake of seismic loss and betrayal? And perhaps even more critically, how do we laugh?" And we laugh. Tonight, the conversation will be led by Alexander Chi, Associate Professor of English at Dartmouth College and best-selling author of the novels The Queen of the Night at Edinburgh and the award-winning essay collection, How to Write an Autobiographical Novel. It's great to have you both here with us. The screen is yours.
Thanks, Andy.
Thank you so much, Viet, for asking me to talk to you about this sequel to Committed. I'm just going to throw, I know you have many copies behind you handily, but I'll flash my own. I confess when I first heard about it, I was almost jealous of the idea of going back to a character for a second novel, even as I was also apprehensive. And I say jealous because I think, you know, easily the biggest challenge of any novel is the creation of the character in the world, right? And in a sequel, at least in theory, that work is done. But what pulled you back?
Well, first of all, it's great to be here with you, Alex. I think the last time we were having a conversation was at the LA Times Book Festival, which we actually did into, you know, talk about how to write an autobiographical novel, which is a great book for everybody who's out there watching. You know, the sequel part, you know, when I wrote The Sympathizer, I didn't have any intention of writing a sequel or a trilogy, which is now what it's turned out to be. But at the end of the book, of course, I had to write another book. And when my agent asked me, well, what are you going to do next? I thought, well, why not write a sequel? Partly because the Sympathizer, among many things, is a spy novel. And in the world of the spy novel, sequels and trilogies and series are acceptable. But more than that, I think I was just not done with the character of the Sympathizer. I felt like there was more to his story that I wanted to find out. And partly it was that the story was about him being a revolutionary who had lost his revolution. He was disillusioned. And I wanted to know, what do revolutionaries in search of a revolution do? Because I think typically in the West, when a communist revolutionary is disabused, they usually run to the West. That's the part of the genre. And that wasn't going to happen with my narrator. So I wanted to find out what happened to him. And then, you know, when I wrote The Sympathizer, another thing that struck me was that I was learning more about this character that I had ostensibly created, but who had taken on a life of his own. And one of the things I learned about him is that I was taking a lot of pleasure in writing this spy who, among other things that he was doing, was also, you know, a womanizer and taking a lot of pleasure in ogling women and talking about women. And at a certain point in the novel, I thought, wait, I'm enjoying this way too much, and this is possibly problematic. And in as much as the novel is a critique of, you know, American imperialism and capitalism and all this, I thought that he himself needed to understand more about himself and about this masculinity and heterosexuality that was driving him. And so in the sequel, in the committed, you know, he goes to Paris to take up this other issue of his French heritage, French colonialism, what a revolutionary might do now. And, you know, how is he supposed to rebuild himself as a man after everything he's discovered about how problematic that manhood is?
How did you go about researching what we might call Vietnamese Paris, for lack of a better, which is to say, Paris as he would have experienced it? Did you already know a lot about it, or what sort of archive did you have to either find or create to dramatize this?
Well, my wife and I had gone there to Paris a few times before the writing of the book, and you know, we'd fallen in love with Paris, and we'd spent a long honeymoon there, 7 months. And I commemorate that in the novel. The one address that's cited in the novel is where we spent 7 months in Paris. And I, you know, our inclination was always to hang out in the non-touristy parts of Paris. You know, not to go back to where Baldwin and Sartre were hanging out, and Hemingway and all that, but you know, to be more in the immigrant parts or the non-fashionable parts or the non-touristy parts. So I was already sort of familiar with that part of Paris that I wanted to write about, because I knew I didn't want to write the stereotypical American goes to Paris novel, sort of the romanticism of modernism, or just the tourist fluffery about the Eiffel Tower and baguettes and all that kind of thing. So it's going to be a grittier novel in a grittier Paris. And partly that was because it was going to deal with immigrants and refugees and people of color. And so, you know, for the purposes of writing the novel, I had an excuse to go and visit Paris again for a couple of summers. And thankfully, the geography of Paris doesn't really change. And even the physical look of Paris didn't really change that much from the 80s to the time when I was there. So to capture sort of the look of Paris, I watched a lot of movies from that time, listened to a lot of music from that time. And then I talked to, you know, French people of Vietnamese descent and asked them what their life was like. And the problem that I ran into was that I told them I want to write a crime novel about Vietnamese gangsters in Paris doing things like dealing drugs and running brothels. And they were like, there's no such thing as Vietnamese gangsters in Paris. We don't do that kind of thing. And I was really struck by that, because I'm a Vietnamese American, grew up in Vietnamese refugee community, and we Vietnamese Americans do that kind of stuff. We do a lot of that kind of stuff. So I don't know what happened to the French of Vietnamese descent. But I told them, okay, well, I think what I'll do is I'll make our gangsters in this book ethnic Chinese from Vietnam. And the French of Vietnamese descent were like, yeah, Chinese people would do that. So that helped solve the problem.
That's fascinating. Did that and did you fact check that beyond that conversation? Like,
well, in fact, one of the most legendary Vietnamese gangsters, Bai Vien, who was a river pirate in Saigon in the 1950s, did go to Paris. And there's, you know, legends about him like walking the Champs-Élysées with a leopard on a leash, you know. So clearly that was the case. And I came across, you know, references to, this is something I mentioned in the committed, you know, that there was a Chinese gangster called Le Chinois, but there was also a French Vietnamese police chief who was also called Le Chinois. So there was, you know, there were traces of this history that were out there. And I thought, it's still a novel. I can still take some traces and amplify them. And, you know, again, nobody had any problems with this idea that there were Chinese gangsters in Paris. And, you know, I just assumed that Vietnamese people must have been doing some bad stuff, but maybe they're just more discreet about it than the Vietnamese Americans have been.
Right. The first rule of Vietnamese gangster club is we don't talk about Vietnamese gangster club. Exactly. We have no gangsters. Would you like to read from... read us an excerpt from The Committed.
Sure. Well, you know, one thing to know is that you don't have to have read The Sympathizer to have read The Committed, although I don't know why you wouldn't have read The Sympathizer. But, you know, The Sympathizer, very briefly, is about a communist spy in the South Vietnamese Army in 1975. And when Saigon falls or is about to be liberated, depending on your point of view, he flees with the remnants of that army to the United States to spy on their efforts to take their country back. And eventually his adventures bring him back to Vietnam. And then he flees Vietnam again as a refugee at the end of The Sympathizer. So The Committed picks up exactly where The Sympathizer left off on this refugee boat leaving Vietnam. And that's what I'm going to read to you. We, the unwanted, wanted so much. We wanted food, water, and parasols, although umbrellas would be fine. We wanted clean clothes, baths, and toilets, even of the squatting kind. Since squatting on land was safer and less embarrassing than clinging to the bulwark of a rolling boat with one's posterior hanging over the edge. We wanted rain, clouds, and dolphins. We wanted it to be cooler during the hot day and warmer during the freezing night. We wanted an estimated time of arrival. We wanted not to be dead on arrival. We wanted to be rescued from being barbecued by the unrelenting sun. We wanted television, movies, music, anything with which to pass the time. We wanted love, peace, and justice, except for our enemies, whom we wanted to burn in hell, preferably for eternity. We wanted independence and freedom, except for the communists, who should all be sent to re-education, preferably for life. We wanted benevolent leaders who represented the people, by which we meant us and not them, whoever they were. We wanted to live in a society of equality, although if we had to settle for owning more than our neighbor, that would be fine. We wanted a revolution that would overturn the revolution we had just lived through. In sum, we wanted to want for nothing. What we most certainly did not want was a storm, and yet that was what we got on the seventh day. The faithful once more cried out, "God, help us." The non-faithful cried out, "God, you bastard." Faithful or unfaithful, there was no way to avoid the storm, dominating the horizon and surging closer and closer. Whipped into a frenzy, the wind gained momentum, and as the waves grew, our arc gained speed and altitude. Lightning illuminated the dark furrows of the storm clouds, and thunder overwhelmed our collective groan. A torrent of rain exploded on us, and as the waves propelled our vessel ever higher, the faithful prayed and the unfaithful cursed, but both wept. Then our ark reached its peak, and for an eternal moment, perched on the snow-capped crest of a watery precipice. Looking down on that deep, wine-colored valley awaiting us, we were certain of two things. The first was that we were absolutely going to die. And the second was that we would almost certainly live. Yes, we were sure of it. We will live. And then we plunged, howling, into the abyss. So he gets to Paris, and I'm just going to read one very short passage here. And he decides, he's been through a lot in The Sympathizer. He's been deeply traumatized. So he makes some bad decisions. And this decision that he makes when he gets to Paris in terms of what he's going to do for a living is that he's going to become a drug dealer. Was I actually becoming that most horrid of criminals? No, not a drug dealer, which was a matter of bad taste. I mean, was I becoming a capitalist, which was a matter of bad morals, especially as the capitalist, unlike the drug dealer, would never recognize his bad morality, or at least admit to it. A drug dealer was just a petty criminal who targeted individuals. And while he may or may not be ashamed of it, he usually recognized the illegality of his trade. But a capitalist was a legalized criminal who targeted thousands, if not millions, and felt no shame for his plunder.
I love the swagger of your narrator. Even at his most desperate moments, I find it amusing. There's something about it that pulls us through the story, even when we don't really know what's going to happen next, in that way that can sometimes arrive in a thriller. And to me, it strikes me as being very voice-driven. And I wondered if it was his voice in part that pulled you back in.
Well, you mentioned at the beginning that, you know, it's difficult to create a world and to create a, you know, a character and a voice. And that was true for The Sympathizer. I spent a few months trying to figure out the right way into the novel. And then when I hit the opening line of The Sympathizer, "I'm a man of two faces and two minds. I'm a spy, a sleeper, a spook, a man of two faces and two minds." I thought, that's it. That's That's the voice, that's the rhythm, that's the sentence that's going to define the entire way in which the novel is written. And you're right, I think by the end of The Sympathizer, I thought, I actually like this guy. You know, I sympathize with him, even though he's a complicated person and he's done some bad things. And it was hard to walk away from that voice and that character. And so it was great to get back into it with the committed. And I'm committed to doing one more novel with our sympathizer narrator and to finish the trilogy with him. Looking forward to keep going with his voice, because I think there's still more to say when he goes back to the United States in the third part. But I think that every good series needs to know when to end. I don't know how many TV series I've watched where I thought this is started great, overstayed its welcome. So as much as I love The Sympathizer, his voice, which is partly my voice, has to come to an end sooner or later.
What do you feel like? I'm trying to think of how to put this exactly. What would you say you learned about his time in Paris? About that Vietnamese refugee experience? Was there some insight into your own life or circumstances or history, connection to history? I mean, you've done so much writing about this experience, scholarship, nonfiction writing, fiction writing.
You know, I think it's always good for an American to leave the United States. And I'm an American, you know, I mean, I came when I was four and I grew up here and I'm deeply immersed in American culture and language, English language and all this kind of stuff. And what that means is that, American assumptions that are deeply held by the overwhelming majority of people in this country are held by me too. And they can be hard to dislodge, even when I think of myself as being resisting or oppositional in some way to dominant American culture. And I think one of the deepest ways in which American assumptions have been embedded in me is the reflexive feeling that everything is seen through an American lens. You know, when I claim, for example, that I'm a Vietnamese American or an Asian American, and I do this in order to, you know, affirm these cultures, but also to fight back against racism and erasure and all this, you know, the American part is still there. And I think this is true for a lot of Asian Americans. We sort of unselfconsciously, many of us at some point or another, just assume the American nationalist point of view. So we're working internally within the United States to deal with some really problematic issues. And yet we may be blind to how we participate in American imperialism overseas or American colonization that's happening now. And so being in France, you know, it's important to me because number one, it allows me to sort of de-romanticize the French. That was really crucial. And I think one challenge of writing the novel was to be able to think against sort of all my own mental colonization by the French. You know, as much as I go around saying, hey, I'm opposed to French colonization, I also go weak in the knees whenever I hear the French language. You know, so that was one thing I had to confront. But the other thing was, again, to throw the Americanisms into relief and to think about how the arguments that I'm making in The Sympathizer could be extended to The Committed and the arguments that I make about, you know, race and colonization here in the United States or what the United States has done elsewhere could be applicable in other contexts of European powers colonizing, or specifically here in what the French were doing. And then also the other thing is, like, the French of Vietnamese descent are not like Vietnamese Americans. You know, there's some overlap, but they're really French. You know, so it's really interesting to butt up against their assumptions in a productive way, you know, because a lot of the French of Vietnamese descent, number one, said, we have it pretty good here. You know, the French like us because, you know, and we get along. And I would think, well, maybe they like you not just because you're Vietnamese, but because you're not Black or Arab or Muslim, which hardly ever was proactively offered by them. But at the same time, you know, their experience that it's possible to be French, that there is something about this universalism that they at least got some entree into, you know, it did challenge certain, you know, assumptions that Asian Americans have that universalism is not possible.
If you had to distill that I guess it sounds as if, I guess, that there's some sort of strange pride to be had in that cultural legacy, even as it is also made complex. Is that the by the conditions of it? Made complex always sounds like a way of saying, like, I promise not to complain.
I would be a lot more, positive about the French and Vietnamese perspective if, you know, their claims to being capable of becoming a part of this universal identity, that universal possibility that the French, you know, dominant French culture really, really believes in. And we're seeing this played out, you know, now. There's all these debates happening in France, and New York Times is reporting a lot on these debates in France about, the desire for universalism against these so-called American importations of identity politics and all that. I'd be a lot more affirmative about the French and Vietnamese idealism about the possibilities of being universal if they could get that while also being fiercely critical of French colonization, which, you know, generally they're not, or that's at least not what I was hearing or seeing. So, you know, the committed is committed to the idea that we have to talk about French colonization as an expression of racism and power that whose effects still linger in Paris and France today, and that the French and Vietnamese descent benefit from that.
So you mentioned The Sympathizer as being a spy novel and The Committed as being a sequel, but not necessarily a spy novel, right? It's more of a crime novel.
Yeah, he's no longer a spy. He's lost that official function of that. His mission is over. You have to read The Sympathizer to find out why his mission is over. So, you know, I mean, the Sympathizer is very much a spy novel with a goal. He has a task he has to accomplish. And in The Committed, he is a drug dealer. It's not really a life pursuit, you know. I mean, he sort of just falls into this, and that sets up a crime narrative. There's a lot of violence and drugs and all these fights that are happening throughout the book. But he's also it's also a crime novel that whose larger crime is French colonization. And so, in that sense, it's not something that can be that's a crime that can't be solved. It's embedded everywhere in French society. So I think the tone of The Committed is a little bit different than The Sympathizer. I think of it as a novel that also sets us up for the final installment of the trilogy when he gets back to the United States. So in the final novel of the trilogy, there will be, I think, a resolution as he goes back to the United States to make amends and to seek revenge. But in the Committed, he's in between these two bookends.
Do you want to talk to us about this aunt character who greets him essentially on his arrival? She's one of my favorite.
If you read The Sympathizer, you know he's writing these letters in The Sympathizer to his supposed aunt in Paris, who is actually not his aunt, and she's his partly his handler. You know, she's sending messages from him back to communist Vietnam and vice versa. So he goes to Paris in the Committed, and yes, she greets him at the airport, and he and his blood brother Bon, his best friend, have just gotten out of a year in a refugee camp in Indonesia. They're not looking too good when they get to the airport. So her first comment to them is, you need some haircuts and you need to go shopping for some new clothes. And he thinks she's really French. But she's also French and Vietnamese. Like, she's also of mixed race ancestry. And that was an important issue for me in both The Sympathizer and in this novel. But she works as an editor for a French publishing house. And she's an intellectual who likes to smoke hashish. This is partly how he becomes a drug dealer, as he realizes he can sell hashish to all of her intellectual network. But he meets this intellectual network through her, of the French leftists, French politicians, French writers, French intellectuals. These are all descendants of 1968 in Paris. You know, these are all radicals, or people who want to be radicals or think they're radicals. And so part of the novel is the satirization of the French left and of French intelligentsia. And there's a lot to satirize, especially if you've been reading the news out of France over the last several years. So there's a character in the novel, BFD, this French socialist politician, who's sort of modeled on DSK, Dominik Strauss-Kahn, the real socialist leader of the socialist party, you know, who was alleged to have raped his maid, but who was definitely confirmed with he and his high-end friends of having their own high-end prostitution ring. And all that comes up by the end of the novel as well.
For Americans who have not been paying attention to the news out of Paris for the last few years, is that, would you say that's roughly what you're referring to with the headlines, or is there something else that you want to
There's lots of little tiny incidents that I knew of that I put into the novel without footnotes, you know, like there was like one episode where this French actor, 50-year-old guy, you know, went on the record saying, "Hey, I love Asian women. There's nothing like the body of a 20-year-old Asian woman." He had a whole string of Asian girlfriends. That was kind of a scandal. You know, the French women justifiably got upset. And there's no shortage of that kind of stuff happening, you know, in the news. And the other reason that the aunt is there in the book is that the sympathizer and the committed are both confessions. You know, we're purely within the narrative, the perspective of the sympathizer as he's telling his story. And I needed to have characters like the aunt in there who would call him on his problematic points of view. You know, she's a feminist, she's a radical, you know, and she introduces hopefully a feminist perspective into the book, her along with her eventual lover, the handsome and humorless lawyer. You know, they're there along with other women to put the brakes on his relentless, you know, investment in his own masculine point of view.
I like that. Yeah, the scene where the cigarettes show up is one of my favorites. It reminded me actually of this wedding gift that my mom passed along to me that she and my father had received. It was this beautiful Korean lacquered with mother of pearl sort of cigarette case with ashtray. It was the kind of thing that you're supposed to set up at a party and like, so that your guests can pull their cigarettes out, and there's a ashtray built into it. And my mother was such a vehement anti-smoker. She used to pay my brother and I to hide our father's cigarettes. So this was never, it was never going to get used. And I'm not particularly sure why she passed it along to me, but I do love it. There's lots of these kinds of details that I think were part of what I loved. And I wondered if you had any favorite of these kinds of like gestures, like right as a novelist, we're always, when we're doing this kind of historical fiction, even in the 80s, we're always looking for those kinds of gestures that may have passed on or no longer be done. Are there any favorites for you that you managed to include in here?
I think it's a tricky thing, right? Because you also don't want to be too obvious about it. Like, oh, here's the author dropping in historical detail just to make sure that, you know, he or she did, or they did their research and all right. of that. But I don't know. Yeah, my favorite, one of my favorite scenes was, you know, our sympathizer starts his drug dealing career by going to the apartment of one of these aunt, friends of his aunt, who is known only as the Maoist PhD, and it's, you know, the apartment is an apartment that I've seen often in Paris. It's the Haussmannian apartment. It's the classical kind of apartment that you see with, you know, creaky parquet floors and the fireplace and the huge gilt mirror and the, you know, the secondhand furniture bought from the flea market. And in his case, he's an intellectual who specializes in American cinema. So there are these posters of Vertigo and King Kong and American movies like this. And the Turkish rug on the floor. And unfortunately, our narrator, you know, is when he's come with the hashish, and as he goes to the front doorstep of the Maoist PhD's beautiful apartment building, he steps on canine excrement, which happened to me in Paris. Okay. I was like, oh no, I cannot believe that I did not see this. It's all over the streets. And, you know, our narrator, is, you know, he's like, okay, what do I do now? I can't get this off, but I got to go up and make this sale. And it's starting to stink in the elevator. Elevators in Paris are very, very small. And then as he gets to the door, he thinks, well, you know, the French are barbarians. They don't take their shoes off when they go into their house. So I'm just gonna follow the custom and walk in there with my shoe the way that it is. And you know, the last thing about this scene is he also thinks about the fact that the one way that the Vietnamese are more civilized than the Parisians, the French, is that you will not find dog poop anywhere on the streets of Vietnam, because the Vietnamese have already eaten all their dogs. And if they haven't eaten their dogs, they keep them indoors, so that if the dogs got out, they'd be eaten. So there's no dog poop on the streets of Vietnam.
We are going to turn now into, if I have us on schedule, into the question box. Folks who are watching, if you have questions you'd like to ask, please just go to the Q&A section of the screen on the lower right-hand side.
I like low humor. I indulge myself quite often in both of these books in low humor. I do not have a problem with that.
Well, that makes this next question interesting. Going into The Sympathizer, given the subject matter, I could never have imagined how laugh-out-loud funny it would be. And from all I've already heard, the same seems to be true for The Committed. Can't wait. Can you talk about how you use humor in your work and why that's an important tool for you?
Well, you know, nobody who knew me before I wrote The Sympathizer would have said Viet is a funny guy. Just never would have come up, you know. And when I set out to write The Sympathizer, I did want it to, you know, be, besides being a spy novel, be sort of an anti-war novel in the way that Catch-22 was an anti-war novel, for example, or in this case, in the French context, Journey to the End of the Night by Louis Ferdinand Céline, major French novel of the 1920s. That was a big influence on The Sympathizer, and quite scatological in its approach. So I just decided I was going to do it, and I don't know how it happened, but it turned out I could actually, I think, be funny in that novel. And partly it was, as you were suggesting, Alex, at the beginning, you know, I created a character who could be funny, who could see absurdity, because he was, you know, caught between two sides, and he could always see behind the facades of power and its hypocrisies. And he was somebody who was sarcastic and irreverent. And once I created him, then all of a sudden he could say these things. And then either I was saying these things or he was making me say these things. I'm not sure which, but it's actually been quite liberating, because, you know, now I can like make jokes in public in events and things like this, which I never really could do before. And so I wanted to continue that in The Committed. You know, I think it's kind of funny, you know, but it maybe depends on people's sense of humor. If you don't like poop jokes, there's a few poop jokes in the book, you know, and I think there's a political and metaphorical purpose to this that I won't give away. I'll leave it up to the literary critics to decipher the poop jokes. But he continues to get himself into these really embarrassing and difficult and painful situations. And I think humor for me works in two ways. You know, it works to both allow our sympathizer to punch up, because he's always using humor to talk about, you know, the failures of the powerful, in this case, our French colonizers and their hypocrisies. But the humor is also always being used against him. He's always the butt of the joke. And I think that hopefully also makes him vulnerable and therefore easier to identify with, versus being someone who's invulnerable and only making jokes at the expense of others. So, for example, in this book, he finally gets a name. He was nameless in The Sympathizer. In this book, he gets a name because he has to have a passport to get into Paris. And the name in the passport is Vo Yang. And he says, this is a joke on the French bureaucracy, because Vo Yang in Vietnamese actually means no name or anonymous. But as he tells us next, you know, the reason why he uses this is because in the cemeteries of Vietnam, where the dead soldiers of the communist side are buried, there are a lot of graves and tombstones marked only with Vo Yang. That is literally tens of thousands of soldiers died anonymously. And so in the end, by calling himself, he's the butt of the joke. It's not just the French who he's playing a joke on, but he himself, unfortunately, is also the object of this joke.
it's it becomes almost like a cosmic joke, right?
Yeah.
it makes me think of, I mean, the kind of light that a good joke like that can cast inside of a manuscript is something that is part of the power of it, I think, right? The power of the mixed feelings that you experience as you get the joke, as the joke seems to transform in the telling and transform as the novel continues. It's fascinating. So let's see. Someone has asked if you will be making the audio book for these books. Will you be reading them?
No. I did read the audiobook for The Refugees, and that was kind of complicated because I thought, okay, I'll give this a shot. And then I realized as I was reading it, I was like, oh, there are accents in The Refugees. I mean, there was like Australian accent, English accent. I was like, oh. So I had to call my English editor, Peter Blackstock, and I said, Peter, can you read this line to me on the phone and record it so that I can try to assimilate an English accent? So after that, I thought maybe I shouldn't do this again. But The Sympathizer had already been recorded by an actor named Francois Chow, and he does the Committed as well. And I think he's perfect. And he's a deep, gravelly, masculine voice, unlike me. And Francois is actually, you know, an Asian American actor. And I didn't realize this because I'd seen his work on the stage and on screen. But then when we talked, you know, I found out more about his biography. And it turns out he's actually Vietnamese, and he was born in Cambodia during the years of the war, because there were a lot of Vietnamese who were there. And then he left at a very young age, came to the United States, and grew up as an Asian American. So his French is also very good. So it's perfect for The Committed.
Was there any one character that you had a problem fleshing out or letting evolve?
Any one character fleshing out, letting evolve?
Where it was difficult maybe to find them in some way?
No, but I think, you know, there's a whole one setting in the novel is a brothel called Heaven. And it's owned by the boss. I have very imaginative names for my characters, but you know, the ethnic Chinese crime boss is called The Boss, and one of his endeavors is this brothel called Heaven. And so it's populated by Asian prostitutes. And I was worried about that setting, because again, as I said before, you know, we're seeing this world purely through the eyes of the sympathizer. He's got a lot of hang-ups about masculinity and heterosexuality. How is he going to interact with these women? What are they going to say? How are they going to behave? Are they going to be stereotypes if I do this wrong? And all of that. So that was something that was concerning for me. But the reason I put them in there is because they will serve a function later on in the novel that I can't give away here, but also because, you know, I think that it is important to acknowledge that racism and colonization are fundamentally also, you know, inextricable from sexual exploitation and sexism and patriarchy and all these kinds of things. And that prostitution in the colonies and in, you know, overseas military endeavors is absolutely a part of the Western imagination of Asia and of Asians in Western countries. One of the sources for the book is this book called Race, Sex, and Colonies. It's only in French, but you know, if you want to get it, it's fine because most of it is pictures. And it was really, you know, useful and disturbing resource for this novel because it documents all the many different ways that the French and all their many different colonies in Asia and Africa have sexually imagined the women and the men under their rule. And so that was why it was really crucial just to have this narrative of sexual exploitation running through the book. But I also knew I had to be really careful with these characters as well.
After writing now two novels, both of which require such extensive research and preparation, do you have a sense of momentum or completion as you head towards the third? What are your feelings of satisfaction also after these writing arcs?
You know, The Sympathizer was a great joy to write. It was 2 years of uninterrupted time. I was on leave from my university. No one knew who I was. No one bothered me. It was fantastic. And then The Committed was much more interrupted as a writing process because I just got a lot busier and a lot of speaking events and op-ed opportunities and all that kind of stuff. So it was, you know, it was more of a relief to finish the committed than it was with the sympathizer. You know, I had to like sort of every time I had a break in the writing, I'd have to, you know, and then I'd resume writing. I'd have to go back and reread everything I'd written in order to get back into the flow. So it was a much more laborious process. But I think hopefully my hope is I've gotten a hang of the different demands on my life and how to try to balance the writing, because I'm writing a nonfiction book right now. And again, a very interrupted writing process, but nevertheless, I'm getting maybe more joy out of writing it than I did with the committed. So, I mean, in the fall, because of all the politics that were happening with the presidential campaign, and I was doing a lot of stuff with that, I didn't write, and I was teaching, so I didn't write for 3 months. Very frustrating. But then mid-December to mid-January between classes, I wrote 30,000 words of the nonfiction book. And so I'd been thinking for 3 months, and I was able to just write a lot in a very quick span of time. So I've had to also, you know, to sort of get used to the idea that different phases of my life will allow me different kinds of writing. And, but it's still really frustrating not to be able to write every day, especially when I'm in love with a story as I have been with these books. So I am looking forward to the third book. I think I have a pretty good idea of 3/4 of the plot, and I'm going to try to get back into the same groove as I did with the sympathizer, because it's a joy that I wish every writer will have at least once in their lives, and maybe twice in my life.
Do you have any advice for anybody who's planning to write a trilogy?
Read a lot of trilogies. I mean, no, seriously, that's what you. Whenever you write something, you should read a lot in that, whatever that subject
Fair
is.
Fair enough. Yeah.
The reason you do it is so that you can see what's really good and what's not so good. And you know what to do and what not to do. And you also know what to allude to. So these novels allude to a lot of different things because I see these novels as being spy novels, crime novels, a trilogy, but also as being, you know, part of the American literary tradition and hopefully international literature. And in the committed, because it's set in France, there's a lot of references to French philosophy and literature and all this, which is fun, I think. Okay. But with a trilogy, you know, I was worried about it. I was like, okay, so how do I, even with a sequel, it's like, how do I even do a sequel? And so thankfully I'd already read, you know, a lot of series of detective novels and, you know, could sort of see how someone like Walter Mosley, for example, deals with E.Z. Rollins in his series. But I also listened to Don Winslow's Border Trilogy, which is a fantastic trilogy about the border of the drug wars between Mexico and the United States. And I could see what Don was doing narratively and politically in these books. I mean, it's really interesting because the reason why I think he's a great crime writer, and I think what makes a good crime writer, he understands that the drug crimes that we obsess about, or some of us obsess about as Americans, are nothing compared to the systematic crimes of the governments, the United States and Mexico, and the drug syndicates. I mean, that's where the real crime, that's where the real crime is. And then the point that he makes is that the drug wars are simply another manifestation of US wars. He makes a direct connection from Vietnam and Cambodia to the drug wars. And this is exactly the landscape in which the committed is operating. So, you know, it's inspirational to look at people working in the genre that I've chosen for this book. And then also with Don to see, you know, from one book to the next, how did he recapitulate the plot? So that, you know, you could fall into a second book, for example. It helps to have read the first book, but you don't have to. You can just fall into the second one, just go and just have enough of reminders so that you know what preceded it. And that's what happens in the committed. You know, it's sort of written so that there's enough clues given periodically throughout the book to situate the reader. So you should still read The Sympathizer, but if you haven't read The Sympathizer, you'll be fine.
I'm just imagining like what the literary version of previously on this in the committed, you know, like the kind of casting back, which actually makes me wonder, like, is this going to be, has this been optioned? I'm sorry for not checking that before our conversation. Is this going to be made into a TV series?
It's been optioned, but the production company hasn't publicized it yet. I think because they're waiting to land an actor. I mean, we've landed the director. Now, the director I am super enthused about. When we got the director, I thought this is crazy, because the director made a movie that was sort of a big influence on The Sympathizer. And when I wrote The Sympathizer, I based it on TV series, because I spent the 2 years of The Sympathizer writing it watching TV, which I hadn't done for like a decade. So I'd watch like The Wire and Sopranos and Mad Men and Breaking Bad. And so that's why The Sympathizer has 26 chapters that are all the same length. They're like episodes. And I'll just tell you a little anecdote about this optioning process, you know, and I don't know if you've been through any kind of similar process, Alex, but you know, when the novel was first published, you know, I had an Asian American producer approach me, and we hit it off. You know, we were totally on the same page, and she has a very established track record. She was very enthusiastic. And then she went off to try to sell this as a TV series. And she came back and she said, well, this is about 2016 or 2017. And this is about the time that Narcos was out, you know. And she said, well, look, we can't get this done unless we get, what people are telling me, she says, is that we can't get this done unless we get somebody like Keanu Reeves to be in this TV series, because he's mixed race, right? Okay. And I thought, well, Narcos, which is like a $40 to $50 million TV show, has nobody famous in it, but somebody found it worthy of $40 or $50 million. But right. You know, for us, we need Keanu Reeves. No problem with Keanu Reeves, but we need Keanu Reeves, who's not even Vietnamese, for one thing. And so that didn't work out, you know, the producer who did the option for it, is actually Canadian. And then, you know, I thought that's perfect, because Americans will screw me on this book. I mean, if Americans were to adapt this, I'm pretty sure all the American hangups about Vietnam and race are going to come through here.
Wow.
So thankfully it's a Canadian who's running the show right now.
That is fascinating. Well, I was going to ask you about favorite trilogies, but I feel like you've kind of answered that. But beyond Don Winslow and Walter Mosley, is there another trilogy that you might want to shout out?
Well, not a trilogy, but I read also Elena Ferrante's Neapolitan Tetralogy during this time of writing The Committed. And, you know, it's very far from The Committed. But what was really cool about that book, number one, is that it's really, those books, is that they're really, they're interior driven as well. You know, you spend so much time on the emotions of these two women who are at the core of the Neapolitan Tetralogy. And, you know, I thought that was very inspiring. So likewise, in these books, The Committed and The Sympathizer, it dwells a lot just on, you know, the emotional textures of one person. But what was also cool about her four books was each one, or at least the first three, ended on a cliffhanger. I mean, these are very, you know, they would be mischaracterized or stereotyped as domestic novels of womanhood or something, or girlhood. But they were actually quite thrilling to read in their investigation of emotional textures, but also they left you with these emotional cliffhangers at the end. And that was what I hoped, how the Committed would end as well, that hopefully people would want the next story at the end of The Committed, just as I wanted the next chapter or next book in Ferrante's series.
Thank you. All right. I read Interior Chinatown on your suggestion after I read The Sympathizer. Both novels changed my life and illuminated many aspects of the Asian American experience. Do you have any other suggestions?
Tons of suggestions, of course. In fact, the LA Times asked me today, give them 7 books about the Asian American experience. I think they're doing a whole section of these. And obviously it's because in the light of, you know, the shootings in Atlanta. So I came up with, I'll just tell you the 7, and they're all by women. I just thought it was really crucial to foreground that, you know. But I think it's Maxine on Kingston's The Woman Warrior, you know, sort of this classical, you know, the canonical Asian American text. Teresa Chau's Dictée, a beautiful and complicated and challenging book. And, you know, Teresa Chau was murdered and raped in 1982. And so that's definitely a part of the history that we're dealing with here. Kathy Park Hong's Minor Feelings, which talks about Teresa Chau and what happened to her and Dictée, but also it's a book about, you know, the necessity for Asian Americans to own their feelings and their rage, which makes her a perfect spokesperson for what's happening today.
Yeah.
Jessica Hagedorn's Dog Eaters, about the Philippines and martial law. It's a really fun, queer, revolutionary novel. Lily Hayslip's When Heaven and Earth Change Places, about, you know, one girl and woman's experiences during the Vietnam War, which also involved revolution and sexual violence as well. How Nanny K. Trask's Native Daughter, from a native daughter about sovereignty in Hawaii. And, you know, it challenges, I think, a lot of, again, we're going back to these American assumptions, challenges the fact that Americans don't think of themselves as an imperial power or a colonizing power. But if you go to Hawaii from the perspective of Native Hawaiians, that's exactly what's happened and what's happening. And so I think it's difficult to go on a vacation to Hawaii thinking of it as a paradise after reading that book, because you realize that Hawaii is an outpost of American militarism and imperialism. That includes the appropriation by the military of so many native lands in Hawaii. That's only six. There's a seventh one. Oh yeah, Karen T. Yamashita's I, Hotel, which is sort of, I think of it as the great Asian American novel, because it's an account of Asian America from its foundation in 1968 through one of the major historical events for Asian Americans, which was the defense of the I Hotel, the residence for old and aging Filipino laborers that Asian American activists were trying to protect from being evicted.
That's a remarkable list. I am going to end here with, let's see. Would you please talk about the notion of the absurd as it relates to successful revolutions and successful narratives of decolonization? That seems like a...
That's a very challenging question, Jason.
That's very challenging.
I'm looking at the chat myself. You get an A. Well, you know, I, as a college student at Berkeley, was very idealistic, still am. And part of the idealism was trying to grapple with what it meant to be someone who came from a country defined by decolonizing revolution in the case of Vietnam, and coming from the losing side, you know. So I spent a lot of time trying to think about what if I'd been born 10 or 15 years earlier, what side would I have chosen? And then what if I'd been, you know, on the wrong side, and what would have happened if I'd ended up in a re-education camp? And so, you know, the question of the absurd was the way for me to try to resolve these problems, because it seemed to me that when we look at violent revolutions in the immediate aftermath, they're often absurd, you know, because those who are idealists and who come to power oftentimes abuse that power themselves. That's the end of the sympathizer. Only with a long distance does the absurdity fade away. You know, like after a couple of centuries, for example, will anybody remember if the Vietnamese communists are still in power 2 centuries from now? Will anybody remember the re-education camps? Will anybody remember any of their failures in terms of the abuse of power? Or will it be exactly like the American Revolution? You know, 1/3 of the American population opposed the revolution. And I think, you know, they were all basically, you know, tarred, feathered, and exiled, right? But we don't talk about that anymore. That's all gone. So I've yet to read, I think, an absurdist account of the American Revolution. Maybe somebody should do it. But it seems to me that absurdity.
But I kind of want that now, actually.
Yeah, I want it. Maybe I should do that. I'm an American writer. I'll write the absurdist account of the American Revolution. But it seems to me that absurdism is absolutely crucial to respond to one element of revolution, which is, you know, the necessity to speak truth to power. And we can do that very seriously, but we can also do it through comedy and satire and absurdity. And that's still the spirit of revolution. And so one line in The Committed says, I think, you know, revolutions are dead once the revolutionaries stop laughing, something like that. Once they start to, you know, once the revolutionary can no longer take a joke, you know, the revolution is over, because then they can't brook self-criticism, genuine self-criticism. And I think that, you know, for me, the function of literature like The Committed and The Sympathizer is self-criticism. I mean, the narrator is constantly being forced to criticize himself as he criticizes revolutions. And that to me is a genuine revolutionary spirit that we need to retain, no matter what revolution we're talking about or what stage it's in. That's the role. One of the roles of the writer is to keep that joking, satirical consciousness alive through things like absurdity.
I think we have time for one, at least one more, actually. I'm going to go to perhaps a related segue. What's the meaning of the title? Who or what is he committed to? Can you disclose?
Well, the committed, right? The committed writer. That was something, you know, I, again, from my Berkeley days, I was like, oh, I want to be a committed writer, like my heroes, you know, the people I really admire. Edward Said has a new biography out of him, and he was certainly a committed intellectual and a committed writer. So that was sort of the model for me. But I was also, you know, really aware of the critique of commitment that people like Chinmin Ha have made. Adorno, for the philosopher, you know, Theodore Adorno, has a whole essay on commitment where he celebrates the notion of the committed writer. But then Chinmin Ha, the Vietnamese feminist filmmaker and theorist, responds to that by saying, well, the committed writer is also committed to power. They're on the side of power. And that can produce danger. You can see that. Again, you go back to the idea of the revolutionary. The revolutionary is committed. That's also what this novel is about. But the revolutionary is so committed to the revolution that they'll commit terrible things as well. Like if you stray away from the party line or the orthodox line, the correct line, you can be the objects of this committed application of power. So that's a twofold meaning of the title: the necessity for idealistic commitment, and then the fact that being committed can drive you to do terrible things. And so one of the historical incidents that's brought up in the novel is the Khmer Rouge and Pol Pot and what they did in Cambodia, that all the leadership of the Khmer Rouge were all intellectuals trained in Paris. You know, they got their ideas from the French. I mean, the French said, hey, democracy, liberty, equality, and the Cambodian students were like, yeah, that sounds great. How about us? And then they decided to take the French Revolution to, from their perspective, the logical conclusion. And that's commitment. And in that sense, it's also insanity, what happened in Cambodia. And so that's the other dimension of commitment, being committed, at least in English, to the asylum. And you know, here the asylum is France as a country of asylum for refugees, the way it likes to imagine itself. And here the asylum is the asylum for the mentally ill, or those classified as being abnormal in some fashion. And this will also be a presence in the committed as well.
Wow. Thank you so much for this conversation. It was a delight to talk to you about this book.
I wish we'd ended with poop jokes instead of, you know, that. But thank you so much, Alex. It was really great talking to you. Thank you to the audience for your great questions.
Have a wonderful evening. And I look forward to when I talk to you later.
Bye, folks. Bye, Alex.
Bye.
Thank you for listening to this podcast from the Free Library of Great Conversations. If you live in Philadelphia or are planning a visit and would like to attend an author event, information on the series is available at freelibrary.org/authorevents.